Mr. Ramses Nassif on March 9th, 1998 in Geneva, Switzerland, and I'm Jean Krasnow. Okay, so we're going to put this right between us here. And for the record, Mr. Nassif, would you please provide us with some background on yourself and where you were born, educated, and then when you began your work at the United Nations?
I'm Ramses Nassif, an Egyptian born in Cairo. I graduated from the American University in Cairo back in 1954. And in 1945-46, I worked as assistant professor of journalism at American University. And all my life has been more or less in journalism. I joined the United Nations in 1953, incidentally the same year that the late Dag Hammarskjöld was elected Secretary General of the UN, succeeding Jim Healey. But there was absolutely no connection between the two. It just happened, a coincidence. And from 1961 to 71, I was the spokesman for Secretary General Font, the third Secretary General of the UN. And when Font retired in 71, I moved to Geneva, where I held the post of Director of Information of UNCTAD, the UN Conference on Trade and Development. And I took early retirement in 1981. In 1988, I had a book published by St. Martin's Press in New York and Hearst. Should be. You can edit this later.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Oh, Hearst and Company, yeah.
Hearst Company in London. And right now I'm living in Geneva and I'm doing a monthly column or a monthly article for the Tribune de Genève, which is published here.
Oh,
in Geneva.
I see. Okay.
That's really about the subtotal. Okay.
And your book that you published is on the life of Utant, or
no,
Utant.
It was actually on the Utant years as Secretary General.
As Secretary General.
From 61 to 71.
I see.
And Brian Urquhart, whom I believe you must have...
Oh, I know him, yes.
...was kind enough to write the foreword to the book. And...
Okay, well, that's good. We had discussed earlier that for the purposes of this interview, we would talk about your role as spokesman for the Secretary General Utant in those years that you were working with him. What was his position in the UN at the time of Dag Hammarskjöld's death? He died September 17th, 1961 in the plane crash. So what was
At the time, Utant was ambassador of Burma to the United Nations, and he was a leading member of the so-called Afro-Asian group. That was a group that was founded after the Bandung Conference, Bandung, Indonesia, in 1955. And he was also the chairman of the standing committee of the Afro-Asian group on Algeria. This was a small unit the Afro-Asians established it to monitor the development of the Algerian question in the UN. Of course, Algeria was part of France at the time. That was before the independence of Algeria. That came much later. And the circumstances of his election really was partly fate and partly the diligence and the concerted efforts of two gentlemen who are no longer with us, unfortunately, Frederick Boland of Ireland, who was the president of the Assembly in 1960-61, and Attlee Stevenson, the U.S. ambassador to the UN.
Okay.
Both were very close friends of Utrecht, and it was Boland who conceived the idea that perhaps Utrecht, coming from the group of the Afro-Asians and from a small, neutral country in Asia, would be a candidate that the Soviets would not dare to veto, because at the time the Soviets were hung up on the idea of a troika, which was promoted or rather advanced by Khrushchev in the General Assembly of 1960. That's the assembly that saw the inelegant, to say the least, of Mr. Khrushchev taking his shoe and pounding the table in front of the cameras and rather disgraceful performance.
Yeah, a very famous event.
Infamous event. And so it was Boland who was pushing for Ossant, and in fact he took Ossant with him. Because at the time, Ossant was the president of the Afro-Asian group. They used to rotate the presidency every month. To see Gromyko in New York, Gromyko was there as head of the Soviet delegation to the UN.
I see. Okay.
And to discuss the question, this was after the sudden death of Dag Hammarskjöld, as you said, on the 17th of September 1961, and to discuss about the inadvisability of the Troika. And when Ossant accompanied Frederick Boland, he was completely unaware that Boland had in mind him personally as a suitable candidate. Other names were mentioned, of course, at the time. One was Monkey Slim, who was the president, an Indonesian foreign minister at the time, who was the president of the General Assembly in 1961. He succeeded Boland. And another name was Ralph Enker from Finland. So those were the three names mentioned, Ossant, Monji Slim, and Ralph Enker.
Okay.
And when Boland reported to Attlee Stevenson, who incidentally was a very close friend of Ossant at the time, that it was Ossant, and he briefed him in the interview they had with Gromyko, Stevenson really took Ossant under his wing and started to first, I suppose, he must have cleared it with Washington, being the ambassador of the United States, and then with the Western group, Britain and France, and there was a little anecdote about the French. Apparently the French were not very enthusiastic about having Ossant because he didn't know French.
Oh,
and then there was a silly rumor circulating that somebody said that he happened to be a very short person, you know, as far as, you know, his height.
Yeah.
At that point, Ossant was very friendly with it's an amusing incident, but it's true, it's history. Was very friendly with Bill Otis, a correspondent of the Associated Press. And whenever he saw Bill, he stopped him and to chat with him. So he stopped Bill Otis deliberately. He said, I've said, made a rather undiplomatic statement. He said, tell them, Bill, that I am a little taller than Napoleon, and Napoleon did not speak English.
That's a good story.
But it was a very undiplomatic remark from a man who was extremely correct, extremely affable, polite, and very, very meticulous about everything he said, but he did say that.
Now, did he serve as acting Secretary General for a period of time?
For a year.
For 1 year he
For 1 year he was acting Secretary General, from because he was appointed acting Secretary General on November 3rd, 1961.
And did the Security Council appoint him acting Secretary General?
Yes, the Security Council elected him unanimously as acting Secretary General with the idea that he would serve the period that Dag Hammarskjöld would have served until 1963, because Dag Hammarskjöld died while he was serving his second.
That's right.
Second term.
Yes, okay.
But that, since we are on the subject, not as well, conclude this point. And then after the his intervention in the Cuban Missile Crisis in October, November of 1962, the Security Council met then and confirmed him for the full period of the four remaining years as Secretary General. So he served as acting Secretary General for 1 year.
Oh, I see, okay.
And then he was re-elected in 66 for another period that carried him until the end of 71. So he served 10 years.
Okay, that's very excellent. Thank you for clarifying that. That was
so that's, you know, I mentioned all this so that it would all be in on this one point.
On this point, right. I see. So then, and then when he was elected as Secretary General, not just as acting Secretary General, was that also unanimous within the Security Council?
Yes. It was. It was unanimous the first time, and it was unanimous the second time, and it was unanimous the third time when he was extended for the other 5 years.
For the next 5 years. Okay, well, that's very helpful. Now, I wanted to talk to you, there were, when he came into office in 1961, Dag Hammarskjöld had died in the airplane crash on his way to negotiate a peace agreement in the Congo. And we'll come back to the missile crisis, but I wanted to ask you some questions about the Congo. Because you stepped into a period of time in which there was a lot of chaos and there was a lot of controversy over the peacekeeping operation in the Congo.
I mean, he inherited the Congo.
He inherited the Congo, that's
the Congo,
right.
From day one, and it was a mess, a real mess at the time. Unfortunately, it still is today. It is a very unfortunate and very unhappy situation, but it was, if you recall, it was established by the Security Council on the initiative of Dag Hammarskjöld.
The Congo operation. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which was called UN Lingo, following the French initiative of the operation. And at that time, Chombe was continuing to defy the UN to maintain the secession of Katanga.
Yes.
And the hostilities started between the UN force and Chombe, and I suppose under pressure from the Africans and under pressure from his own advisors, Ufang finally gave the order that he should clear all the mercenaries from Katanga and reach their own objectives, which was the freedom of movement.
Yes, actually, now that I wanted to ask you about that, because that was a very important decision for the UN to be able to use force.
Yes.
To remove the mercenaries. And you mentioned that it was a difficult decision.
It was a very difficult decision. It was a decision that he took reluctantly, but there was no other way to deal with it, because just to put an end to the chaotic situation there, and Shombi was acting as, you know, his own free agent, although there was a government in Katanga, and there was a government in Yopanville at the time, which was the central government with Prime Minister Adula in charge, and Shombi opted to ignore it. But finally, there was an agreement between Adula and and Shombi, and the Belgian government played a role in bringing them together because they had a lot of influence on Shombi.
Yeah, okay.
And so that was in January 63, when the Belgians transmitted to Ufant a message from Shombi that he will finish and terminate the secession of Katanga, and will cooperate with the United Nations. I'm reading from notes here because I don't want to say something that is incorrect, but the notes are my own from my book.
Yes,
so I'm not
that's fine.
I'm not stealing from anybody. And Kasabubu granted amnesty to Shombi and to his... Kasabubu was the president to members of Shombi's government. And on the 29th of June, 64, Ufant submitted, when all this was done, a report to the Security Council on the withdrawal of the UN force from the Congo. But unfortunately, more conflicts and more incidents followed. There was a hostage taking of foreigners, some 1,000 foreigners in Stanleyville.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah.
And then Shombi decided to free the country, and he fled in October 65. He was living in near Madrid in Spain, and in 1967 a very unusual incident took place while he was flying from Mallorca back to the mainland. His private plane, was hijacked by a French mercenary and taken to Algeria. Until today, we've read a lot of conflicting reports whether this mercenary was on the pay of the new government of the Congo, and he did that in order to have Shombi extradited back to the Congo. I don't know, at least I myself, I don't know the whole story. And this mercenary took him to Algeria, and the Algerians put him under, gave him a nice villa, but sort of under surveillance outside the city of Algiers. And at that time, Mobutu came to power, asked the Algerians to extradite him. They refused for some reasons of their own. Either they didn't want to show that at the time Mobutu was very, very close to Washington, whether the Algerians felt that this, by doing that, they are making a gesture towards Washington. I don't know.
Okay.
They kept him there. And finally, he died of a heart attack in June 1969 in captivity in Algeria. So that is in a sort of a telegraphic
Right.
I mean, without going into all the details, this is the episode of the winding up of the Congo operation under Interwar Front.
Right, right. And Chombi is a complex and interesting character.
Yes.
And he came to a kind of ironic end.
Rather sad.
Sad, yeah.
Yes, he died in isolation outside his country.
Yeah.
And yet he was quite a figure. He was quite a figure and quite a reason of conflict too, in a sense.
Yes, right. Well, I wanted to go back to the decision to use force, because you mentioned that that the Africans and others in the UN had put some pressure on to end the secession.
Yes.
So could you explain that a little bit of that the Africans did not want Katanga to secede? Yes,
absolutely. They were for the integrity, the territorial integrity of the Congo.
I see. Okay.
And, but the order for the to use force was given by UFAN. There's no I'm just trying to.
And were the U.S. In general was also in favor of the integrity of the
U.S. was, but not the Europeans.
Not the Europeans.
Not Belgium and not Britain, not France.
Uh-huh.
But the U.S. was.
And how did the Soviets at that time play into this?
Well, the Soviets, they played a very important role at the beginning when Lumumba was Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
But after the assassination of Lumumba, which was they accused Chombe and his mercenaries of carrying it out, that was one of the reasons, really, that the Soviets turned against Khrushchev. And that was one of the reasons why Khrushchev, at the assembly of 1960, attacked Hammershaw personally.
Mm-hmm.
And Hammershaw retorted by a very short but very eloquent response, saying, "No, I have no intention of resigning.
Mm-hmm.
I will not resign as long as the smaller, weak nations of the member states, among the member states, need me and need the United Nations." And he received the standing ovation.
Yes.
In response to Khrushchev's boisterous speech of he must resign and to be replaced by a troika. So the Soviet Union at that point had very little influence at the That's why they felt that Lumumba's death was a blow to their influence, to their prestige,
mm-hmm.
because of the colony. And one of the main reasons why they turned the minister back home.
Now, you had mentioned the Troika. Just briefly, could you explain what their proposal was on the Troika?
The proposal was is that they wanted the Secretary General to be replaced by the Troika, one from the Eastern Bloc, one from the Western Bloc, and one from the Non-Aligned.
Oh, I see. And the three would serve together?
They served together as three Secretary Generals.
Uh-huh.
Nobody bought that suggestion.
Uh-huh.
President Kennedy in the United States at the time, because he was the President of the United States, and Prime Minister Nehru of India, who was a very powerful, very respected voice, came against the Troika. So nobody bought the Troika. But when Hammershaw died, when he had a tragic death in Mirandola, they revived them, but they didn't find really much support in the people. That's why when Boland went over to discuss this whole thing, Gromyko sort of mentioned it casually and then dropped the subject.
Okay.
Completely. And that's why they thought that, well, if we can get someone, not from the world, but from this emerging Appalachian group, they would not, the Soviet Union would not be able to take the people. And they didn't.
And they didn't.
They didn't.
Okay, that's a very interesting background of how that developed. I just had another question on the Congo, and then we can move on. But as you mentioned, Lusant had authorized the use of force to remove the mercenaries. And after that, the fighting still really continued for about a year. And then in December of 1962, the gendarmerie in Katanga launched an attack on the UN forces that were in Elizabethville.
Yes, in December 62, the gendarmerie harassed and fired upon the United Nations forces in Katanga. They shot down a UN helicopter, killing an Indian officer serving with UNOC. Responding to an urgent request from Robert Gardner, and General, he was the Secretary General's representative from Congo, and General Prem Chand, the Indian commander of the UN forces,
yes,
found reluctantly issued the order to remove the gendarmerie and the mercenaries from Elizabeth. That was the immediate cause for the order.
Okay, and so he had received word that the helicopter had been shot down.
Yes, oh yes. I mean, these people were reported.
Yeah. So in that sense, because there had been an attack, the UN could respond because it was considered self-defense.
Self-defense, yeah. And here the British and Belgian governments voiced serious objections and urged him to rescind the order. They protested that any military action by the United Nations would result in the destruction of the Union Minière, the vast Belgian-owned industrial complex in Canada.
Yeah. But despite the British and the Belgian objections, Lusant...
The order prevailed until this thing was cleared up.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And then, of course, there was a ceasefire. I mean, it wasn't just for... they just didn't go on fighting all the time, the UN force.
Uh-huh. They did proceed to... they decided to take a town called Jadotville. And in order to actually remove, they sort of followed the mercenaries,
yes,
and then
yes,
till they could actually remove them.
Yes.
So it went a little bit beyond the, an order simply of self-defense.
Oh yes, yes, you're quite right. Yes.
And
it was a breakdown. Wait, can I read another paragraph?
Oh, sure, that's fine.
That was on December 30th. Somehow there was a breakdown in communication between Leopoldville and UN headquarters in New York. On January 3rd, 1963, so that's past that period.
Yes, they're right.
Gardner cabled that UN forces consisting of units from India, Ethiopia, Tunisia, Ireland, Sweden, and Ghana, boosted by 10 fighter planes and 2 reconnaissance aircraft provided by Ethiopia, had entered the town of Jadotville, an important junction. They had met no opposition, and the mercenaries had fled. They moved forward, destroying 2 air bases and occupying all vantage points and tests.
Okay. Now, what I wanted, and perhaps this is, you know, an awful long time ago, it's hard to recall, but there was an important period there where they had had authorized the use of force because they had been attacked, because the helicopter had been shot down. But then the UN went on to take Jadotville, which was not necessarily an act of self-defense.
Right.
But you had said briefly there was a breakdown in communication.
Yes.
Was there really a breakdown in communication?
Oh, yes. There was.
So the UN forces thought that they had the authorization to continue,
to
follow the mercenaries.
To continue, and perhaps also a feeling among them, you know, among the forces there, is that now that we've started, and here I'm speculating, now that we've started the job, that is our friendship. rather than stop in midstream and then have to do it all over again.
Yeah. Do you recall what Yufan's response was when he heard that they had moved forward and taken the town of Jadabjo? Was he surprised?
He was surprised, but I don't think he was unhappy about it.
Yeah.
And at the time, of course, in New York, the man in charge of the operation was the late Ralph Bunch.
Yes.
Who was the in charge of the Congo operation, assisted by Brian Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the feeling was, since they've started, let them get something, give them enough leeway to finish their job. And then during that period was the message from the Belgian government to Ossant saying that Sombi has decided, which I referred to earlier, in January 63,
yeah,
he decided to end the secession.
Right, right.
And to come back to the fold of the independent Congo, and provided that the Kasamugu will extend his amnesty to all members of his government, Chombe's government.
So was it felt that Chombe had decided to end the secession and sign a peace agreement because of the force that the UN had taken to remove the mercenaries from Katanga?
Yes, I think that was an important element in his decision. And I suppose I could add on my own without implicating anybody else,
Right.
Most of these people are no longer with us. Chombe was never a popular
within the UN itself, he was never
popular. He was never popular, he was never liked. In fact, at one point, Ossant said publicly at a press conference in Helsinki, in fact, when Chombe's name came up, he said, to my knowledge, Mr. Chombe is not a stable man. Which, coming from Ossant, he was not given to give any such outspoken statements. So, to put it bluntly, nobody liked Chombe, and nobody sort of shed any tears.
Yeah. Had Yufan been frustrated by Chombe and his behavior?
By giving his word and creating it 24 hours late.
Yeah.
He did that more than once.
More than once, yeah. Yeah. The other question that I wanted to ask you is just one more or so on the Congo. The UN left the Congo in June of 1964. By the time the Congo operation had ended, there had been 126 UN personnel killed, including Dag Hammarskjöld, Secretary General. And the total costs were $400 million. In that period, in the early 60s, $400 million was a lot of money.
It was the largest operation ever undertaken by the UN until that time.
Up until that time. What was the reaction within the UN to the expense of the Congo operation?
I don't think, everybody realized that it was a very expensive operation, but the member states paid it up, and the only country that did not pay was the Soviet Union.
And why was it that they didn't pay?
They didn't pay because they said that they don't approve of this particular operation.
They didn't approve.
They didn't approve, and that was the starting point, fooling around with the voluntary contributions to cover peacekeeping.
Yeah.
So it started that, and they withheld their contribution to the Congo operation. And in fact, Othmane, in his first official trip to Moscow, apropos of this, made in a statement to the Moscow radio, he said, if the Soviet people were to know the facts about the Congo operation, they would not take the stand of opposing the operation or to withhold their contribution to it. And that part of his interview with the Moscow radio was not taken out, was not broadcast.
That part was not broadcast.
We found that out later, of course,
by
checking with our information office in Moscow. That part was taken out, censored out.
Yeah.
That was in July 1962, the trip to his official visit.
No, there's a provision in the charter that if any one country is 2 years behind
Article,
in their payments,
Article 19.
That they would lose their vote
in
the General Assembly. So what happened to the Soviets during that period of time?
Well, what happened to the Soviets was we had a General Assembly that was completely paralyzed because of that, because of this Article 19, which incidentally, if you want to put it in historic perspective, as you know, this U.S. owes the U.N. over $1 billion in arrears, but the U.S. has always managed to pay that much to cover its arrears so that it would not exceed the two years.
Yeah.
You're aware of all that.
Yeah.
So I don't have to bother you with these details.
But so how did this General Assembly work around that?
Well, they didn't. I mean, it had a General Assembly that did not function. So this is completely blocked and stalemated by this, and they met and in and out, and nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very unfortunate, a year lost, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
A year lost because of the Soviet
intransigence.
That's a cycle. It's a word that I find.
So, but the, eventually they did pay.
Eventually they did.
Yeah.
They found a formula to say that they're paying under the guise of the regular contribution, but they did. Eventually they did pay.
Okay. Oh, I see. So they worked it out so that it was under the regular dues.
Yes, under the regular dues, so that they kept the principle of not giving in. It took some time, but they came around.
So then their vote was restored.
Yeah.
All right. I just had wanted to clarify that in that issue. All right. Now let's go back, because many these things are all happening at the same time, and it's good to talk about them in, you know, separately and issue by issue. Othmane came in as Secretary General, and as you had mentioned earlier, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. How did the UN first become involved in that?
In the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes.
It all started with the Soviet Union built bases in Cuba for missiles that were capable of carrying nuclear warheads of a range of 2,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Here I'm quoting the President of the United States at the time, John F. Kennedy. And on the 22nd of October 1962, President Kennedy told the American people that the USSR has done that, has built those missiles, and as a result, we the US, are going to have, I have decided, declare a naval and air quarantine of Cuba around their international waters.
Mm-hmm.
In the same evening, Ambassador Stevenson asked for an emergency meeting with the Security Council.
I see. Okay, so the Ambassador Stevenson,
yes,
from the United States, yeah, called for an emergency meeting of the Security Council.
Meanwhile, an hour later, Ambassador Zorin of the USSR called for an emergency meeting, and Zorin happened to be the president of the Security Council that month.
Oh,
you know, they rotate,
yes,
every month.
So Zorin was the president.
He was the president.
Ah.
And the Cubans, on their in turn, asked for a meeting. So the council met from the council, that was the 22nd October. The council met on the 23rd. And on the 23rd and on the 24th, and it was completely deadlocked because the U.S. introduced a resolution asking for the removal of the missiles. The Soviets introduced a resolution calling the U.S. naval blockade of Cuba an act of war, and Cuba, of course, protested the U.S. measures of blockading Cuba.
Okay.
So
okay,
there was a complete deadlock. And that's when Wuthan decided at the following meeting, which was on the 24th of October, still 62, of course.
Now, just to, let me talk about that Security Council meeting for just a moment. Wuthan, was he present during the meeting of the council on that day?
His Secretary General is always at every meeting of the Security Council.
Wuthan would be, because other secretaries general didn't always do that.
No, he was the exception.
Uh-huh.
He was the exception. But every secretary general, Rigby, Badenoff, Wuthan came, Valtan came the Courier.
Yes.
And now we have Kofi Annan. They always attended every meeting of the Security Council, unless he, the Secretary General, is away on some official mission.
Okay.
Then
so Boutros Ghali was the only one?
The only one. And in my judgment, and if it's on the air, it's on the air, in my judgment, it was a mistake.
Yes.
Because you are sort of implying that you had other more important things to do.
Yeah.
But as the French say, chacun son goût, to each his own. He's a fellow Egyptian,
oh,
so to say
that's right. That's right. So Wuthan was at the meeting. And now, what was the status of the Cubans at that time? Were they on the Security Council at that time?
No.
But they were invited to.
No,
but
they were invited because they were a party.
Because they were party.
Cuba was not a member.
Okay, all right. So they were all in the room together.
They were all in the room together.
Okay.
And then, when he found that there was this deadlock, the three resolutions, none of them will go through because the Soviet Union would veto the U.S. draft, the Soviet would veto, and the U.S. would veto the Soviet draft and the Cuban draft, so there was a complete deadlock, and the situation was really very serious because it was eyeball confrontation between the two nuclear powers.
Right.
So at that point he decided to make an appeal and to make it a public appeal and to also coupled with two identical appeals to Kennedy, to President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev, incidentally, at that point, some of his advisors said that, you know, you are acting Secretary General, that was before this confirmation.
Yes.
'62, because his confirmation came in November after.
Yeah.
And the whole future of the UN might be jeopardized by your action. And his reply was very, very typical, really, of the fact that, you know, all these things are academic. If there is a nuclear war, there's nothing about ethics at the general, even the existence of the UN, or mankind itself. So I don't find anything to do it. And I am going to do it.
Yes, right.
So he went around and he made his appeal. It was a very dramatic appeal. And he appealed to both leaders in order to avoid even the bureaucracy of going through their missions and their delegations. And luckily, his appeal was really based on the fact that the very fate of mankind is at stake. And in his two direct appeals to Kennedy and to Khrushchev, he asked for a sort of